supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next? Ew.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Who hasn't said, why didn't I think of that? We all want to be more creative than we are. And it might seem that the more we chase creativity, the more elusive it becomes. But one of our guests might suggest that creativity can actually be nurtured with the right kind of work and practice. And more practice. We have two eminent scholars here to discuss the subject today. Dr. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi is the founder and co-director of the Quality of Life Research Center. His long lists of publications include such books as Creativity, The Psychology of Discovery and Invention, and Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience. Mike, it's nice to speak with you. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Actually, I don't know if you'll recall, but when your book, Flow, first came out, how long ago was that, Mike?
That was in 1990. So it's 24 years.
Yeah. Yet you were on the show when the book first came out.
I do remember.
Oh, my. Well, we're also joined by Dr. K. Anders Ericsson. He's a professor of psychology at Florida State University and one of the world's leading experts on the subject of expertise itself. He's written several books, including The Road to Excellence, The Acquisition of Expert Performance in the Arts, Sciences, Sports, and Games. He's also credited, and we're going to talk about this later, credited with the 10,000-hour theory, which was famously misrepresented by Malcolm Gladwell. Anders, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And later on, we're going to hear from award-winning poet Ellen Bass, who's been multiply published in the New Yorker. Her most recent book is Like a Beggar. And if you'd like to join the conversation about creativity, what it is, how it works, how it can be nurtured, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Mike, let's start with you. You know, when thinking about creativity, I tend to go back all the way to the beginning and the creation story, which was literally a story of creating something out of nothing. Is that how you define creativity?
Yeah. You want me to answer? Yeah, all right. Well, story is in most cultures. They have created creation stories because that's a kind of basic question that people sooner or later start asking. How did we get here? What made all this stuff? Animals, trees, volcanoes, and then humans. And it is, the assumption is that it was an act of some kind of a supreme power made all of this stuff out of nothing.
Well, is that how you define creativity, is making something out of nothing?
Absolutely not. We certainly are not gods and that of that sort. What we can do is improve on the past by learning how things work and it took over 200,000 years for people to discover that the best part of the stones that they were making for their everyday tools to scrape screens and to break bones and so forth, the stones the best parts were those flakes that they threw away from the core, which was in the middle, and they want to get the core as sharp as possible, and they chopped away the pieces of excess stone. But those were the sharpest part.
What a wonderful way of describing your point about what we need and what creativity really is. It's my image is it's a kind of layering of information, and using what we've learned individually and culturally to create new out of that.
Well, that's the way. That's the way I think, because the greatest, when Isaac Newton was asked how come he so far farther than other physicists have before him, he said that, well, it's because I was standing on the shoulders of giants, and that actually, St. Augustine said that 1,200 years earlier, but also the same image that you don't see far unless you standing on the shoulder of those before you have seen.
I think that's such a critical concept, and well, much broader than creativity. I think it's an important concept in our culture, in childbearing, and so on and so forth. But that's a whole different show. And Anders, let me turn to you. Are all humans creative? After all, don't we need to be creative to survive?
Well, I think to me, I have a problem with the word creativity, because it sort of implies that it's a uniform thing that, or a capacity of some general form. I think our work, looking at people who are expert performers in different domains, their, I guess, creativity really seems to be something that individuals, after they've reached sort of the learned everything that is to know in the domain, are then able to sort of make advances that really go beyond what anyone else in the domain knows. So in that sense, creativity now becomes something that is specific to a domain, and it's always judged here on the basis of what people in the domain already know.
So I want you to explain that or give us an example. I mean, it's pretty easy to see with athletes. Right, they go beyond where they have been and where others have been. But what about in the intellectual domain?
I personally feel that if you look at science, you have a sort of a similar phenomenon. And that gets to the issue here of putting yourself on the shoulders of people who have gone before you, of assimilating all the knowledge that they already have generated, so you wouldn't have to generate that by yourself. And it's only, I guess, going beyond that knowledge that other people have in the domain that gives you that sort of credit for being creative, namely that you've generating something that is really new and valuable to the domain. So you're, for example, discovering the importance of, say, DNA, or are able to propose here how you can describe DNA, but it's not like that's happening in a vacuum. It's kind of, really being a sort of a product of working at the really edges of our knowledge, and sometimes you discover things that end up being extremely important for everyone in the domain, and I think that's when people are giving credit here for making a major creative contribution.
So away from the word major, I want to come back to the original question, and I'll ask you both to weigh in on it. Are all humans creative? Mike, you used the term creative people, but isn't there a continuum? Mike, I'll turn to you for that.
Well, depending, compared to the motes of atomic dust floating between stars, which is the major component of the universe we know, compared to that, people are much more creative because we have an ability to sort out and combine information in ways that, as far as we know, no other organism that we know of has. And so in that sense, we could be said as a species to be well poised for creativity. But that doesn't mean that you can expect everyone to discover the DNA or the next DNA, because in order to do that, you have to, as the previous talk has said, you have to immerse yourself in a domain where you are you get to know what we know so far about genetic transmission, and once you get to the edge of what's known, there is the possibility to go beyond, and some people just don't, are not interested.
Yeah, as a little later in the show, I want to get down to that breakdown about who goes beyond and who doesn't and why, but we got a caller raised a question, Anders, and that is, she wonders if creativity, these are her words, can be like an oyster, that an oyster creates something beautiful out of pain. And I wonder if the artist or creative person also does the same thing, so that if everything is comfortable in your life, that there's nothing urging or pushing you to go further.
Yeah, well, when I interviewed creative people, sooner or later, most of them said, you know, I am really worried about this new generation of people coming up, because the kids are never bored. And at first I didn't understand what he meant, what they meant, so I kept probing it. And what they said was simply that the children don't have this kind of grain of sand in their shell, so to speak, that forces them to become creative, because they feel that they are lonely or abandoned or have nothing to do. And yet most creative people start by being bored and trying to figure out what is it that is really interesting around them they can get involved with. But now they say, you know, the kids can go and start playing some kind of shooter game and he never needs to be bored, and because of that
you never get that grain of sand.
I don't know if that's true, but it is a real concern, I think.
I have to tell you, and I want to turn to you, when I read poetry, when I read great literature, it's all born of some type of suffering. So I want to, Anders, according to one test, you might be familiar with this Torrance test of creative thinking. Since 1990, creative thinking scores have been decreasing. So, you know, that's consistent with what Mike just said, that some blame watching TV or computer games or lacking nurturing of creativity in schools. And I also want to, you know, talking about layers, I wonder if part of it is that we're living with a national anxiety disorder. I have felt that for a long time.
Well,
I think that gets to the essence of what we've found when we've been looking for people who excel in various domains of expertise, is that the path to becoming better at something, it's not something that just kind of happens. In fact, we see or find evidence here that what we call deliberate practice is kind of the key to actually change yourself. So somebody who is complacent and watches large amounts of TV and does other things, that person is not changing. And what we find is that if you're going to excel in any domain, you basically need not to sharpen your tools and your skills. And the process by which you do that is really stretching yourself. So without that stretching, now, I believe that there are other motivational forces, like, for example, we know from concentration camps that there was a very large number of people who acquired abilities of doing mental calculation. And in books that they have written about that experience, it was sort of that this gave them a way here of sort of focus their mental life and make it sort of, you know, they would have control over that, so they wouldn't be kind of thinking about the disastrous life that they were leading. And I believe that basically in art, you know, you're actually in some ways constantly at the search for that motivational experience of being able to sort of express something. But I think you need kind of the technical control of actually being able to express that in a way that you, as well as people that you share this with, you know, would have that kind of emotional reaction that is basically very desirable.
Well, let me stop you there, because we're going to take a short break, and then we'll bring on Ellen Bass, an actual artist who will also help us address some of these issues. We're talking about creativity, what it is, what nurtures it, whether we all have it, whether it can be created, and what inhibits it, what stops it. We're talking with Dr. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, who's who's written about this extensively, and one of his books is Creativity: The Psychology of Discovery and Invention. He's co-director of the Quality of Life Research Center. K. Anders Ericsson is a professor of psychology at Florida State, and he's one of the world's leading experts in the topic of expertise. And one of his books is called The Road to Excellence: The Acquisition of Expert Performance in the Arts and Sciences. And right after our break, we're going to be speaking with Ellen Bass, an award-winning poet. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, welcomes clients to their Center for Psychotherapy in Bella Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute provides effective treatment for challenges including depression, anxiety, stress, and weight management. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020. Beck Institute proudly supports WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about creativity today with psychologists Mihai Csikszentmihalyi and Anders Ericsson. We're also joined by award-winning poet Ellen Bass, whose most recent book is called Like a Beggar. Ellen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan. So glad to be here.
And happy birthday, my dear friend.
thank you very much.
I should say that Ellen and I have been friends for about, well, let's just say over 60 years, and we will we will leave it at that. Ellen, have you had a chance to listen to the earlier discussion?
I have been. This is so interesting.
So I have a question about the evolution of creativity here. And that is, many have argued, and I think Mike is one of them, that creativity peaks around age 20. So what about you?
Well, I'm a slow learner. So my trajectory continues on. I think that it's taken me a long time to develop the skills as a poet that I have now. I hope I'll continue to develop them further. I think there have been some ups and downs in my creative life. I'm 67 today, and I think that that for me, it's taken a long time to get to this place because of the learning process and the skill development.
I'm curious about, let me turn to you, Anders. In a 2007 article you wrote in the Harvard Business Review, you cited new research that showed at the time that outstanding performance is the product of years of practice and not based on any innate talent or skill. That's if I read it right. And this certainly has to be more nuanced than that. I mean, I could practice singing for thousands of hours, and all I would accomplish is losing all my friends and family.
Well, let me kind of try to clarify what we have found. And so what we have found is that if you look at people who reach sort of an international level of accomplishment, that nobody just sort of ends up there without a prior history of having worked with well-qualified teachers. And also what we found is that basically it's not any type of disengagement. So, for example, playing chess is not going to make you a better chess player. The way you actually get better is to really find out here that you get that point of the actual borders of your ability, and then you find activities where you can get feedback and actually then move those borders further. My experience is that if you're looking at domains that aren't limited by bodily functions, we see people, you know, remaining here at the very highest levels well into their 60s and maybe even 70s. So my feeling is that you need that prerequisite training, and basically you may, in fact, have to start in some domains at early ages, because it's sort of like you're tweaking your physiological development by engaging in the right kind of practice that a good teacher would basically have you do. I would not also say that, and it's almost impossible to show that innate factors aren't constraining it. So what we're saying is, reviewing all the evidence, we don't find evidence that innate factors are really constraining your ability to reach the highest levels when we exclude height, because height seems to be one of those things that practice at any age doesn't seem to have an influence on.
So, and I'm sure this question gets on your nerves, apropos of that, you've been credited with that 10,000 hour rule that was popularized by Malcolm Gladwell in his book The Outliers. So that was an oversimplification, I trust.
Well, I think we've never argued that there's some magical boundary by which separates sort of the outstanding people. So our work on the violinist kind of showed, contrary to people's opinion at the time, that the very best or most successful violinist in an international music academy actually had spent more time by themselves engaging in what we called sort of deliberate practice to improve. So that really raised the issue here of could possibly that engagement in practice be at least a partial explanation here for, you know, their success as adult musicians. So my argument would be that, as I started out, you know, that nobody reaches the highest levels without a lengthy period of training, typically with a very good teacher that can guide the individual. So what number that is, I think it depends entirely on the competition in the domain, and it probably also depends on the particular domain, how much is really necessary to reach the current level of performance today.
So let's take a domain where I would think the layman would think, and Ellen, I'm back to you here, where the layman would think you just sit back and creative ideas come to you and you just write them down. It's as though something flows through you, and to a certain extent that might be true, but like practice, you know, to the layman, you know, practice and poetry sound almost like an oxymoron.
Well, I'm a perfect example of everything that Anders is saying, because both the years and years of practice and also the necessity of good teachers, not practicing in isolation where you could just go in circles, not really making progress. That's really been my path. And I write an enormous number of hours for a very small number of poems. My last book has took me 7 years, and I think when I figured it out, it was something like about 7 poems a year made it into the book. But that I didn't only just sit down and get struck by inspiration 7 times. I was writing all year long for those poems, and once in a while I do have this wonderful experience of something just flowing out of me, but 95% of the time I'm just practicing.
When did you begin being a poet?
I began when I was a teenager, and I just was passionate about poetry. I just loved poetry. I loved reading poetry, all poetry. I was indiscriminate. I loved it all. And I loved writing poetry, but I didn't show any innate talent. You really could never have told from my early work that I was somebody who was going to take this path, but it came from passion. It just came from love of poetry and the willingness. I'm very kind of mule-like person, and I just decided that poetry was the place where I was going to focus my efforts, because I loved it so much, in the hopes that with enough years, if I lived long enough, I would continue to improve.
You were go on. Who's this?
This illustrates, I think, very well the fact that the differences in domain, because it's true that in the arts people can improve and do some of their best work late in life, because it involves self-knowledge in a sense, or it involves drawing on one's experience and making something new out of it, whereas in the sciences you have to prove things experimentally, and whether you have passion for it or not doesn't make much of a difference, except that it helps you to stick with the work, but the creativity comes from the work itself, in a sense, not from inside you. And the, for instance, some of the best music that, let's say, Giuseppe Verdi wrote are the two operas that are really fantastically new and creative, were Otello and Falstaff. Otello he wrote in the 70s, Falstaff in the early 80s. And they are just gems of youthful passion and good cheer and so forth that you wouldn't expect.
You mentioned that in the Psychology Today article you wrote a few years ago, and I highly recommend that some of these really creative people that, you know, get more creative later in life. And Ellen, you know, Anders just talked about what gets layered on. And by the way, I'm just told by my producers we have a link to the Psychology Today article on our website. But Ellen, I'd like you to read the opening poem, apropos of this discussion, the opening poem from your new book, Like a Beggar. It's called Relax. I think it's the opening poem.
Yes, I'd be glad to. Relax. Bad things are going to happen. Your tomatoes will grow a fungus, and your cat will get run over. Someone will leave the bag with the ice cream melting in the car and throw your blue cashmere sweater in the dryer. Your husband will sleep with a girl your daughter's age, her breasts spilling out of her blouse. Or your wife will remember she's a lesbian and leave you for the woman next door. The other cat, the one you never really liked, will contract a disease that requires you to pry open its feverish mouth every 4 hours. Your parents will die. No matter how many vitamins you take, how much Pilates, you'll lose your keys, your hair, and your memory. If your daughter doesn't plug her heart into every live socket she passes, you'll come home to find your son has emptied the refrigerator, dragged it to the curb, and called the used appliance store for a pickup. Drug money. The Buddha tells a story of a woman chased by a tiger. When she comes to a cliff, she sees a sturdy vine and climbs halfway down. But there's also a tiger below. And two mice, one white, one black, scurry out and begin to gnaw at the vine. At this point, she notices a wild strawberry growing from a crevice. She looks up, down, at the mice. Then she eats the strawberry. So here's the view, the breeze, the pulse in your throat. Your wallet will be stolen, you'll get fat. Slip on the bathroom tiles in a foreign hotel and crack your hip. You'll be lonely. Oh, taste how sweet and tart the red juice is, how the tiny seeds crunch between your teeth.
It's playful and tragic and wise all at the same time. Before we take our break, Ellen, could you have written that poem 20 years ago?
No, I could not.
So why? What's the difference?
I think the difference is the life experience of going through some very painful times and making the commitment to choose joy and to choose being fully present in the moment regardless.
Yeah.
It took me a lot of years to make that commitment.
So that addresses what we talked about earlier, the sand, you know, the irritation, you know, that
yes.
is really the birthplace of depth and creativity. So we've got to take a short break. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. Ellen, you can stay with us?
Please.
Yeah, Ellen Bass, who's celebrating her 67th birthday with us. I can say that, Ellen, because you just did. She's an award-winning poet. Her most recent book's called Like a Beggar. We're also joined by Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, who's the founder and co-director of the Quality of Life Research Center, and Professor K. Anders Ericsson. He's a professor of psychology at Florida State University. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, a guide to saving for retirement when it's decades away, and it starts with skipping that latte.
Pay yourself first, and what I mean by that is just putting that money away into the 401k plan and just pretend it's gone forever.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about creativity with Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, Anders Ericsson, both psychologist and award-winning poet, Ellen Bass. Because of our phone line system here, Ellen, we're going to put you on hold while we take a call so you can listen in. We'll start
Thank you. We'll start with
Dan. Dan, hi, you're on the air. Do we have you?
The discussion, hello?
Yes.
Oh, most of the discussion has been about how creativity manifests in specific fields that, I guess, emerge out of a deep and learned experience and expertise. But what about creatives who kind of cross disciplines and might not have a deep learned expertise in any one field, but called a vision or intuit the links between areas of expertise to create something new?
Give us an example, because I want to make sure you get the answer you're looking for. Tell us, are you talking about yourself?
Just generally speaking, the creativity to kind of survey the landscape, so to speak, in a city or in and kind of have a sense of trends or initiatives, and then seeing connections between separate ventures and kind of combining them into kind of a more holistic approach to that brings together different systems, different approaches to things.
Let me turn to you, and I'm going to ask you to take your answer off the air.
Sure.
So I'm going to turn to you on this one, Anders. This sounds like the skill set of, say, a CEO.
Well, I think it's interesting. What we find, though, is that if you want to objectively measure people's performance, and I would include creativity and sort of such set of measures, it's very difficult, and you really don't have the possibility of basically comparing what, say, 100 people who had the same role, how successfully they would have dealt with various situations, or how they could have created new initiatives that would have had impact here on the company's success. But when if we restrict ourselves to people who make kind of these major contributions that are recognized within the domain and maybe even outside of that particular domain, I think it's very rare to find people who make these contributions in more than one domain. But again, if somebody can name an example, I would be interested in hearing about it. And I think that we need to look here at within the last 100 years, because it used to be that science was a much more kind of rudimentary field where people could make contributions across the board. But if we're looking at today's development of science and arts, I would be interested in identifying people who would have that general ability to contribute across domains.
Well, it depends on what you mean by contribute. Are you getting back to the concept of excel? You know, we've got, apropos of that, one of our callers wondered about, you know, can you address creativity on the more everyday things, more mundane, you know, not these grand, you know, contributions or people who really excel, like Ellen and so many others.
I think that is a kind of an interesting but challenging problem. And I think, at least my view is that when people have created these creativity tests that people use to measure school children and even professionals, they don't seem to be appropriate to predict who is going to be, you know, a very successful artist or scientist or athlete or musician. So I have to say that I'm a little bit feeling here that when people talk about creativity in everyday life, they talk about somebody who has the wisdom of sort of, you know, really thinking through what they're doing and also are free to explore options such that they would be able to find, you know, what is going to be satisfying and appropriate for them and their families.
You know, it's funny, as you're talking, Anders, and I'm, you know, listening back to what Mike said earlier in the show about creativity, this mundane, I recall, you know, I'm a quadriplegic and have very limited function in my hands. I remember years ago, I figured out how to get a pipe cleaner in my wallet so I could get my wallet out of my pouch. And I drove myself to, a local pharmacy, and I got, cough drops. And I got it in a bag, carried the bag on my lap, got back in my modified van and got home. And I got home and I felt so proud, almost exhilarated. And I thought, how lucky am I? How many people in this world would pick up some cough drops and feel this good about it? And that's kind of what we're talking about. You know, it's the creativity of the mundane, getting a pack of cough drops.
Now, to me, that reflects more kind of the emotional engagement in the activity that you are doing. And depending on your situation, that may be very different and may require a lot of pre-existing knowledge. But I think that would be my personal interpretation, that basically engagement in wanting to do things in a better way and the processes that are involved here in actually finding that way and the satisfaction that people find when they are now able to conquer a difficult routine in gymnastics or able to play something at a level that they didn't think was possible. Now, those are the things, but that wouldn't be linked now to any more objective level. It's more that in order to reach the highest levels, you probably have to go through that many, many times.
Mike, you know, you had said the act of creative expression brings us close to a sense of ideal fulfillment, and you compare it to sex, sports, music, and religious ecstasy. Listen, when I got those cough drops, I didn't feel ecstatic, but I did feel a sense of fulfillment.
Yeah, but I think if you want to preserve kind of the meaning that creativity has had for a long time, we have to differentiate it in one way to differentiate those kind of mundane forms of creativity you described is to say that, well, that's creativity with a small c, and it makes your life more interesting, varied, and you can be proud of solving your problems, and that's great. But big C creativity, the one that changes a culture, that changes mm-hmm. the way people see the world, that understand the world, express their view of the world, and so forth. And I think there is a lot to be done on the personal creativity, and because, as you point out, it's a great thing when you can solve a nagging problem in your life by coming up with a good idea. But that is a different sort of, that's really a different beast.
You know, you, Ellen, you know, Mike used the phrase looking at things differently, and I want to address that. You've got one of my favorite of your poems is called Happiness. Remind me which book that's from.
It's not in a book, but it is a poem.
Okay. So let's hear Happiness.
Happiness. I had a student once who was so depressed she wanted to die. She was a young single mother, lonely, poor, watching other girls go to parties and bars while she was home cutting the crusts off peanut butter sandwiches, reading The Berenstain Bears and The Bad Dream. Then she collapsed with heart disease and spent the next few years waiting for a transplant. The strange thing is, now she was happy. Every day, almost every breath, was semi-ecstatic. She was a modern-day Chicana Rumi, hanging out with the beloved, grateful just to touch his hem. I find I'm telling myself all the time now, look how you lift one foot and then the other, all the nerves and synapses firing together. Look how you reach for a carton of blueberries and eat each dusky globe one by one. Look at the spotted dog tied to the newsstand, drops of saliva sliding off his tongue, and the cracked Bic lighter in the gutter, shining a watery turquoise blue. Even when your heart is a used teabag, you can lie down in a warm bed, even though you cry half the night, with the window open a little to let in the stars.
I think that's one of the most powerful poems that I've ever read. But the reason I wanted you to read that poem, Ellen, is because we're talking about vision, and I want to address the idea of vision literally. You use the word look in that poem several times. The way you look, you, Ellen, look at blueberries and the cracked Bic lighter, and on and on. Your literal vision is different than, say, mine or others. And I wonder if that is a part of creativity, kind of seeing the world a bit differently.
I think it's seeing the world, not so much seeing it differently, but actually seeing it, or smelling it, or tasting it, all through any of the senses. We are all, myself included, only a little bit present most of the time. And for me, the most creative state, well, it's kind of paradoxical. It's the most creative state is when I'm more present. And also, creativity allows me to be more present. So
yeah.
they enhance each other.
I am really curious about how you would respond to that, Anders.
Well, I agree with everything, and I found these poems, you know, very moving, and basically, the way I view poetry as sort of helping other people, you know, sort of get in touch here with their feelings, and it strikes me that, you know, that's something that only few people are able to and actually put in the time to allow themselves to do. The issue I have perhaps is, you know, how to relate this more generally to what people sometimes think about with creativity. I don't know, I probably would be more comfortable thinking of some other words to kind of use that experience and that ability to capture in words such that other people can recapture feelings and induce sort of a state in other people that, you know, that is really making a difference to them.
What words would you use? How would you?
I would maybe engagement. And I think that to me seems to be a very big difference between people, you know, where you actually are personally sort of engaged in the sense that you're allowing yourself to feel the feelings. I think there's a lot in our culture where people are just kind of trying to protect themselves against feelings. So allowing oneself to feel the good things, you know, I think by necessity requires you to also confront some of the, you know, feelings that are aversive. And I think when you commit yourself to a task or project, it's a little bit the same way. You're committing to the whole package, and you're going to have to go through difficult, challenging periods along with, you know, these feelings of accomplishment. And when you're able to sort of look back here and really feel like you've reached a long...
Anders, you're starting to sound like the sermon I give to my psychotherapy patients now, because that we can generalize to all of us about life itself. Unfortunately, we are all out of time, and I want to thank all three of you for joining us. My guests have been Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi, Anders Ericsson, and Ellen Bass. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be addressing the important topic of restorative justice. Download our podcasts at whyy.org/voices. On Twitter, we're at Voices in the Fam. You can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. You'll hear about my upcoming lectures there. The engineer has been Al Banks. Lindsay Carfagno is our summer intern. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Gita Simons produces the show. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Please enjoy your week, my friends.
You're listening.